Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine last week announced a series of proposals to reform policing, from banning chokeholds in most cases to mandating body camera for all cameras for all officers. He also wants police departments to make sure they have the right man or woman for the job.
Today I'm asking the members of the General Assembly to require that before a person can begin training to become a law enforcement officer in the state of Ohio, they must first pass a psychological test showing that they are fit to be an officer.
We're going to talk about that and more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us from the Dayton Daily News, state government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jo Engels, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. She joins us by Skype. Hi, Jo. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
And Adrienne Robbins, Statehouse reporter for NBC4. She is new to the show. Welcome aboard, Adrienne.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Adrienne, in Columbus last night, police clashed with protesters, ramming them with bicycles, or I guess using them like shields and spraying them with a chemical agent. What led to the confrontation? What do we know about that today?
I think there's still a lot of investigating going on by the Columbus Police Department, but obviously several videos have already come out from both the police and protesters. It's interesting, though. This is kind of the first blow-up we've seen in a couple weeks. Things seem to have been calming down, and obviously still a lot of frustrations out there.
Yeah. What do you make of it, Laura Bischoff? It did seem like things were calming down, but that's part of the problem for some people, right?
Yeah, I think it. I think that they want to keep the attention on the issue and not just let it fade. And so, you know, protesters are continuing to keep the pressure on. It's my understanding there were about 250 protesters downtown in front of the State House last night. And by the time the clashes started, the crowd had dwindled to about 100. And there were calls to disperse that were not heeded, and that's when they decided the police used, some sort of chemical sprays.
Right, some kind of mace thing. Jo Engels, what's your sense about what this means going forward? As you know, we're going to talk about what they're talking about in the State House in the Ohio General Assembly for reforms. But how do you think this goes over?
Well, you're right. I mean, this was something that it was kind of dying down there. And in recent days, though, there had been incidents and the police chief in Columbus or the police spokesman in Columbus addressed the media saying there had been incidents where CODA buses had been stopped and motorists had been stopped on High Street in that section by protesters. So it kind of led up with some other events happening in recent days. As far as where we go from here, though, I think this is kind of an uncharted territory. I think that there's more of a will among all different agencies to do more community policing, to make some changes, to maybe do some training that would help. But, and that's what the calls are for. But this is kind of how that would apply in this situation. We haven't seen that. So that's what we're going to be watching.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Jo Engels. She's a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Adrienne Robbins, a Statehouse reporter for NBC4. Laura, you wrote about, well, let's talk about what the governor proposed and what he's looking for. He wants to ban chokeholds on all but life and death circumstances. But I thought that was already the case, and that the question is how well police officers are trained to decide when to use such a thing. Also wants to require body cameras for all officers. In general, is there a way to summarize, Laura Bischoff, what the governor is shooting for here? Certainly not disbanding or defunding or anything like that.
No, I think that the common threads of what the governor and the attorney general want, as well as what like NAACP of Dayton, the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, and other entities that are proposing these reforms, the common threads are more training, more accountability, less force, and more de-escalation. And how you get there is up for debate. I think that the opposition to those to these changes might be kind of in each police department's culture. and whether or not they, you know, they want to make these changes. Some of it is also money. You know, deploying body cameras to every, you know, all 32,000 certified peace officers in Ohio, you know, there's a price tag to that. Most of the larger departments do have those already. They may run into some opposition from police unions as well that, you know, that they don't want some of these changes.
Adrienne Robbins, it's like the pressers with the governor when they occur now have sort of morphed, I mean, from about the pandemic to the pandemic, of course, but now also this policing issue.
Absolutely. Well, I think when the governor is going to hold a statewide press conference, we're having statewide protests, it's kind of the elephant in the room. He has to address it. I think one of the biggest things in with his reform plan, we talk about what ties it all together.
Mm-hmm.
What ties it all together to me is that these are things that are going to have to go through the General Assembly, and that is not a speedy process. And obviously people are still very frustrated. Tensions seem to be boiling over yet again down at the State House, and we're asking these people to be patient with a very slow process.
Right.
And I just don't know how those two things coincide together.
Yes, talk about slow. It's the Ohio General Assembly. But something like this, Joe, I'm wondering about city governments and how they might respond and differently than the Ohio General Assembly, and whether the state lawmakers may try to stop local officials from making any changes to how policing is done. What do you think?
Well, they've certainly been on that track lately.
Exactly.
The government, there's been a lot that they've passed that have tried to rein in the city officials. One thing, though, that I noticed here, you know, back in 2016, when the Republican National Convention was held in Cleveland, mm-hmm. there were protests outside of there. And there were police forces who were trained in a lot of the same kind of tactics that they're talking about here. And the de-escalation, for example, I remember watching the protests, and you would see two people who were really getting heated, going after it, and the police officers would walk over and they would one-on-one go up to these people and initiate a conversation and try to walk them away to get them out of the heat of the situation. We're not seeing that by and large, or at least we haven't when I've been down at the protests.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it the color of their skin?
Well, I think there's a different level of trust in the government among some of these people who are out doing these protests. You've got to remember, a lot of these black folks say that they have, for generations, they've seen police officers in a different light. They don't mm-hmm. see them as helpers. They see them as people who are coming to get them, to put them in jail or do harm to them. So I don't think there's a level of trust there. And that's something that's going to be very hard to build, and it might take some time. And that's the reason it makes me kind of, you know, when I see these ideas come out and these plans come out, I sit there and I think, yeah, can that really happen given the climate that exists and the history that exists there? I mean, you're going to really have to have the African-American leaders and communities around this table when you come up with these plans, because that's going to be crucial in the implementation.
Well, who's going to be at that table at the Ohio General Assembly, Laura Bischoff?
Well, you know, this, I think Joe's completely right. When the governor and the attorney general rolled out their police reform ideas, they said that they had talked with the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, NAACP Ohio President Tom Roberts, et cetera. But then the Legislative Black Caucus said that they just got a phone call just shortly before the rollout, and they weren't consulted ahead of time. And the OLBC is headed by State Representative Stephanie House of, I think she's from Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the House Minority Leader is Amelia Sykes, a Democrat from Akron.
Mm-hmm.
And Sykes made the point in a recent floor speech that, you know, for too long, white leaders have said this is what the black community needs, and not consulted the black community or given them the ability to, you know, set the agenda of what needs to be done.
Hmm. What do you think, Adrienne Robbins? Are they going to be at the table or not? And there are, the bottom line is there are very few African-Americans in the Ohio General Assembly.
Right. And I've heard some pushback from other lawmakers who say the process is what it is. We're not going to be bullied into anything. We need to vet these bills and go through everything and find out what's right. So, but it was interesting that the governor seemed like he had everybody on the same page when he originally came out with these reform plans. Mm-hmm. But then very quickly, the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus clearly did not feel like their voices are heard. And their voices are going to be some of the most important ones when it comes to these protesters and people who are frustrated feeling like their voices are going to be heard in the state house.
Surely they're not going to get to any of this in any significant way, Laura Bischoff, before the November election.
Oh, no. No way. I mean, the House has already left for summer break.
Right.
The Senate is really only going to be in session a handful of days in July and August. You know, we don't even have a bill introduced yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only, you know, it only goes till December 31st is the end of the legislative session. And any bill that doesn't clear both chambers and get signed by the governor by then does not become law. And it, you know, the process repeats, you know, that it's reset again in January. And, you know, there's just, the legislature can move very quickly when it wants to. But it can also debate and delay and drag mm-hmm. things out.
They sure can. The governor said on Friday that a criminal investigation is underway to learn who left painted these red handprints on the exterior of the state house. House Speaker Larry Householder has condemned the protesters on Twitter, told them to come and clean it off. The summer's just beginning. I mean, what do you think Householder's willing to put up with? Laura?
Oh, I don't think he's willing to put up with anything. He issued a very stern statement, I think, on Thursday night. And the governor responded with a statement, and Highway Patrol is investigating, and that he had spoken with the patrol superintendent, Rick Fambro. You know, the State House has been, since May 29th, when the protests erupted and about 28 windows in the state house and other damage was done. 28 windows were bashed in, and there was other damage to the grounds. Since then, the troopers have been regularly staged in the state house atrium over the past 3 weeks with like gobs of riot gear at the ready. I mean, I've seen at least 50 ready to go, and I don't know what happened if they because things had kind of started to dissipate, if they mm-hmm. didn't have them at the ready, on that Thursday evening when that happened or what?
Well, I mean, he's asking people, I mean, what are they doing? What's Larry Householder doing? What do you get from him, Adrian Robbins, about the imperativeness, the importance of doing the reforms with police?
Right. Well, I think Laura's right. I mean, House Speaker Householder is not someone who's going to be pushed around or going to take a lot here. Obviously, he's come out against these protesters. But they also, it seems like everybody at the State House right now has a plan for police reform. And there is some overlapping between the Republicans' plan, the Democrats' plan, and Governor DeWine's plan. It seems like at some point they're going to have to get in the room and decide what to go through. Like Laura said, when they want to go fast, they will. It's also very easy for them to slow down the process on things that they don't necessarily want to get done, especially before the election.
Right. Well, we will continue go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to say that, you know, in the House, State Representatives Phil Plummer and Cindy Abrams did introduce kind of a placeholder police reform bill with some general ideas to it, but it has yet to get fleshed out.
Right, exactly. All right. Well, we will continue our conversation. Lots to talk about. That's Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Also, Adrian Robbins, State House reporter for NBC4. And Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Adrian Robbins, State House reporter for NBC4. There's a tiff regarding the former chair of the Ohio Republican Party. He has been censored by the Ohio Republican Party for his role in creating a PAC opposing Donald Trump, supporting the Democratic the expected Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. And what do you make of this, Laura Bischoff? What's the deal with Matt Borges?
The deal with Matt Borges is he has. He was a big John Kasich supporter. Kasich installed Borges as the chair of the party after Kevin DeWine, the previous chair. Kasich wanted to be able to appoint the chair of the party. Kevin hung on and then eventually was left because he knew Borges was going to get the job. And then Borges, he was Kasich's guy, and he backed Kasich for president, and eventually when Donald Trump was the nominee, Borges officially backed Trump, but not super enthusiastically.
Mm-hmm.
And then the president got personally involved in ousting Borges and installing Jane Timken as the ORP chair. So there's kind of a backstory to this. And then once Borges was out as the chairman, he has continued to work against Donald Trump's reelection, and that does not sit well with the Ohio Republican Party.
This PAC that he's formed, how well funded is it? What do we make of that?
I don't know. I haven't looked into the FEC filings on that. And I think it's similar to the Lincoln Project, which is Kasich's political advisor, John Weaver, is involved in that. But yeah, it's, the idea is to get Biden in.
Joe Ingles, how unusual is it to censor a former party leader?
It's pretty unusual. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but this has been building up for a while. My colleague Karen Kassler has been reporting on the developments of this, and Matt Borges has kind of hinted around that there, that this was going, maybe in the future. The thing to really think about this PAC that Matt Borges is involved in, it was Anthony Scaramucci. Remember Anthony Scaramucci?
Oh, that's right, the communications director for the White House. How could we forget? He was there for 10 days.
The mooch.
The mooch.
But, this is his pack. And as Laura said, this pack, the right side, it's called the right side pack, will be working kind of with the Lincoln Project, kind of the same kind of things. The thing that kind of stuck out at me, Ann, is that they're not really doing that much in Ohio. They've kind of written Ohio off as Trump country, and they're going to other states. They're going to Pennsylvania, and they're going to North Carolina, I believe. I can't see all the different states they're going to, but they're not here. There are other swing states. Michigan, I believe, is one of them.
Right. So Ohio is typically considered a swing state, but not anymore.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, and I don't know if it's their internal polling. There's also the fact that when in 2016, President Trump won Ohio by a large margin. So, that.
I think we lost you.
Not a swing state.
Okay. Any thoughts, Adrian Robbins? I know you have been covering West Virginia for the last few years at the State House. Does this sound familiar or not?
A lot of things go on in West Virginia. I mean, when we talk about Ohio now being considered a full red state, a lot of people have kind of revoked its purple status from it. It'll be interesting to see 2020 if it gets returned to that status as a true swing state. But West Virginia is obviously truly Trump country. Previously, a very historically blue state, actually. A lot of people forget that. But there are those factions in the Republican Party in West Virginia and now in Ohio as well. It's similar to kind of what we saw in 2016 when Bernie supporters wouldn't necessarily support Hillary Clinton. Now we're seeing some Republicans lean more towards Joe Biden. And obviously, I think that's what Democrats are hoping the draw of Joe Biden is that he can pull in some of those Republicans. At the same time, you hear a lot of voters and a lot of lawmakers who are labeling themselves as Trump Republicans.
Uh-huh.
And not just putting an R beside their name, but making it very clear who they support for president and what kind of Republican they are. So it'll be interesting to see what the voters ultimately do, because everyone seems to have their opinion on what they think will happen.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what prominent Republicans like the governor does, Joe Ingles, and the state attorney general. The whole state's run by Republicans, basically. So I can name all the names. It doesn't matter, but how they respond.
You know, what we all kind of forget is Dave Yost, the attorney general, back when then Governor Kasich was in office, you know, he was a Kasich guy and, you know, made some very controversial statements about Trump. But then he's gotten in behind Trump. When Trump became in on me, he became right there with him. Kasich has never really come out, and I think there's still, you know, some distance there. He's not definitely doesn't praise Trump, but he hasn't really come out and become part of these efforts either.
The Lincoln Project or the Borges back, yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of standing back. So it will be interesting to see where John Kasich goes from here on this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Adrienne Robbins, from the she's State House reporter for NBC4, and Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Last week, the statue of Christopher Columbus was taken down at Columbus State. City Hall is to follow. Any word about the State House statue, Joe Ingles?
I know that behind the scenes they're talking about things, but there's no official word as to what will happen there. But that's not the only statue at the State House that has come under fire in recent years. I mean, if you look at our and here's the thing, it's a lot of it is history. And if you look at a lot of our history in this state, some of the people that have statues now, they were not people who would have had statues if they were popularized now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, time has changed, thinking has changed. So, you know, there is some thinking behind the, you know, maybe it's time to take some of these down, but it's because we all change. I mean, just remember the Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, we had I can't remember the name, a statue there that was representing Ohio, and it was taken down in favor of
Edison.
Edison.
Yeah, Edison got the spot.
And that's when they were debating, should it be Edison, should it be John Glenn, right. Should it be...
And it was the same thing, though. It was the same debate about, wait, you know, that doesn't represent Ohio. So I think we have this debate over time, all the time.
Whether it's going to stand the test of time. You know, Laura Bischoff, what's your sense about, I mean, again, I think Larry Householder, maybe some other state leaders in the General Assembly have said, no way, no how, they're not going to start messing with our statues.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I know that there was a call from one of the members of the Legislative Black Caucus who is on the Cap Square Advisory Board, the board that oversees the grounds of the State House, to hold a meeting right away on whether or not to remove that Christopher Columbus monument. I haven't heard whether or not Householder is going to acquiesce and have a discussion about that.
Even have a discussion about it would be acquiescing at this point.
Right. And I'm pretty sure, like, most of the statues on the grounds of the State House represent white men. I don't know that there's any minorities or women that are paid tribute.
There are female images, but they're not anyone who was ever living.
Right.
But there are inside the State House. I mean, you know, the George Washington Williams Room is a dedication to African-American lawmakers. There's a women's gallery that has a lot of the women who have served in the General Assembly, and Nancy Hollister, who was the governor of Ohio for a short
11
time.
Days.
Yeah.
So there are things inside the State House, but, you know, maybe not outside.
But let's also keep in mind that in the 200-plus history of Ohio, 200-year-plus history, there's only been two women who've held any of the big three political positions, governor, speaker, or Senate president. Nancy Hollister was the governor for 11 days, bridging a gap when George Voinovich went from governor to the Senate, and before, right. I think, Bob Taft took over as governor. And then Joanne Davidson was the Speaker of the House. And, you know, so the only portraits, the big portraits, are Hollister and Davidson. I think Davidson's got at least, her portrait is painted and hung at least twice in the State House.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, but, you know, is it just about who's served in the State House? I mean, Christopher Columbus didn't serve in the State House, and he's out there. I don't think very many of the people portrayed in statues on the State House grounds necessarily serve there.
Well, and then also there's discussion of if you remove the statue from Columbus City Hall, you know, should Columbus change its name? And there's a social media discussion about whether or not they should, you know, name it Flavortown after who's that celebrity chef guy? Guy Fieri.
Did anyone else know that Guy Fieri was from Columbus? Because I missed that memo altogether.
I know.
Okay.
I've got my hand in the air. I know. Adrian Roberts or Robbins, what do you think the trajectory of all this is going to be?
You know, it's interesting. When there were calls for Christopher Columbus over at City Hall to be taken down, it's not the first time this has come up, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, every couple of years, it seems like we regurgitate this discussion. But this year, obviously, real change is happening. It'll be interesting. Do you leave the one statue? I mean, one's the loneliest number, and it's going to be the last one left over at the State House. So how do you leave that one standing when so many other places have decided that that's not the image they want to portray here in the city of Columbus? At the same time, obviously, will there even be a discussion? I don't know if it's because the statue's obviously a lot smaller over to the side of the State House under a tree, but it seems like a lot of people have kind of forgotten that it's over there. There have been far less loud calls, I guess, for the removal of that statue, and I just would have a hard time believing some of the lawmakers who would ultimately make the decision would even want to, I guess, go near the topic.
Exactly. You know, as far as renaming the city, Laura, I mean, people are still insecure about whether everybody even knows when you say Columbus, it's Columbus, Ohio. I mean, there's already an insecurity there. Can you imagine? Although it probably become more famous if it did rename.
Yeah, although just imagine the debate over, you know, what to call it. It just would be never ending.
Yeah.
You know, though, I think that, you know, Christopher Columbus never set foot in Ohio, much less
served.
And we all remember the 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But they left off of that little ditty is the fact that he brought disease and genocide to people who were already living in the so-called New World.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think this is kind of interesting. Ohio Senator Cecil Thomas wants to eliminate language in the state constitution that gives an exception to slavery. Joe Ingalls, thoughts about that? What more do we know, and what kind of support does he have for that?
Well, I think some in the Black Caucus are behind that. I mean, the thing is that language, you know, Senator Thomas would tell you that language means something being in there, and he would like to see that revised. I think a lot of that language was kind of geared toward.
We lost you, Joe.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Okay. I think a lot of that was, you know, when that came out, it was sort of with the thought of more toward prisoners, people who do something that, you know.
But it still suggests an image, yeah.
Just animated. We're losing me again?
Yeah, kind of going in and out. Laura Bischoff?
Okay.
Yeah, so Cecil Thomas he picked Juneteenth as the day to introduce this resolution to make a point that these words in the Constitution are still hurtful, and they should just tidy it up, get rid of that wording. And it's not a major undertaking. It would just require, I think, a supermajority vote in both the House and the Senate.
And they can amend the state constitution that way?
I believe so, but I'd have to go back to my cheat sheet on that.
Adrian Robbins, any thoughts?
I was going to say, I think I could be mistaken, but I believe it's 60% and then it would go to the ballot.
Okay.
And ultimately be left up to the voters for a change in the state's constitution. But yeah, Senator Thomas has said this would mostly be a symbolic move. He said he just doesn't understand how us as a state move forward at this very contentious time when you have something like the threat of slavery hanging over people's heads. And that's what he called it. He thought that language, although it means very little to some people, and a lot of people don't even realize that the state's constitution says that, he said, to black people, that is a threat to put them back in slavery. And he said, you know, as we move forward, why not just get rid of that? Which, obviously, those words are very charged to a lot of people. And Ohio wouldn't be the first state to get rid of that part of the state's constitution. I believe Colorado did it previously. And there were a lot of talks of how that would impact their prison system. Apparently, prisoners there volunteer to fight wildfires. So they were concerned that they could end up with lawsuits because of that. So there was some pushback. So it'll be interesting to see what the other side necessarily says if they don't want to change the state's constitution. Hmm.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Adrian Robbins, Statehouse reporter for NBC4. Also with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Our guests, Joe Ingles, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau by Skype. Also, Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. And new to the scene, Adrian Robbins, statehouse reporter for NBC4. Thanks again to all of you for joining us. The Dispatch had a big editorial in the Sunday paper this week. Calling for a strong new state health advocate now that Amy Acton has left the job of state health director. I have lots of questions. First of all, has she started her new role as chief health advisor to the governor? What do we know, Laura Bischoff?
As far as I know, she has started that new health policy advisory role within the governor's cabinet. Lance Himes is back at the helm as the interim director of the Ohio Department of Health. He's an attorney, not a doctor. The governor said when he first hired Dr. Acton as ODH director that he wanted a medical doctor and somebody who understood public health. Previously, John Kasich's Department of Health was led for a time by Rick Hodges, who was not a doctor and had previously run the Ohio Turnpike.
And former state legislature later, yeah.
Right. So he was more from the political vein of things. The governor says that he is going to be doing a national search for Dr. Acton's replacement and that it's a work in progress.
You know, a lot of state health directors have been fired, resigned, left for one reason or another in the last few months all across the country. Adrian Robbins, I mean, what do you any sense about how hard it's going to be able to find somebody to replace Amy Acton, especially given the public abuse, verbal abuse she's put up with in her orders to shut down the state and then gradually reopen it?
It's certainly not an easy job. I don't envy the people put in those positions right now because, especially right now, the spotlight is really put on them. I think previously most Ohioans knew very little about their director of health or who maybe it even was. And Dr. Acton was very quickly thrown into the spotlight and obviously got a lot of the bad sides of the spotlight with it as well throughout the protesters, some lawmakers, So I think it will be especially difficult for Governor DeWine to find a replacement, not just because of the situation we're in and what they're signing up for, but like Laura said, Governor DeWine was very clear that it took him a while to find Dr. Acton, and he had very set parameters of what kind of person he wants in that role, and I can't imagine that that has changed.
Right. I mean, Joe Ingles, he's not going to settle for anything but a physician, is he?
Well, I don't know. He wants someone with a medical background, so I would physicians, the only thing I can think of that would really have that kind of medical background. But
I mean, Amy Acton wasn't a practicing physician, right? She was a public health expert.
Well, she was a public health expert, but she also was a physician. I mean, she has that medical training. She's
right.
A doctor. She knows what's happening. And if you were sick, she would have an idea of how to deal with that, even though that wasn't what she was doing at the time. I think that the thing is, you get into these public policy debates like this, and the health side, they're looking at it from the health side. And that's the problem that's going on here. I mean, Amy Acton was definitely looking at what is best for the health of Ohioans. And, you know, there are other people who say, well, my life isn't much good if I can't have my livelihood. So they put their livelihood right up there with their health, and the two do go hand in hand, and it's a very delicate balance. So to try to find a health director who meets the qualifications that Governor DeWine would like, and to find someone who also can ride that line with the business.
We lost you again.
I was going to say this.
Yeah,
sorry.
Laura.
It really is a big job. The Department of Health, aside from managing this pandemic, which is enormous and a kind of a once in 100 years event, we hope, they have 1,400 employees, I believe, in ODH. They really are managing key initiatives from the DeWine administration, such as suicide prevention, reducing infant mortality, reducing lead poisoning in kids, the opiate crisis. ODH does everything from nursing home inspections, regulates abortion clinics, handles all the vital statistics, birth, marriage, death, disease. And keep in mind that public health is all about preventing problems upstream at a systemic level.
Mm-hmm.
So society doesn't have to pay the price downstream. For example, pushing for, broad immunizations leads to less disease later on. Pushing for tobacco policies means less cancer later on. Requiring restaurants and grocery stores to keep food at certain temperatures, it means, less food poisoning down the line. It's all about the systemic approach to people's health.
I'm wondering about what's happening with the pandemic in Ohio. Laura, Governor DeWine said that Dayton, Cincinnati, and Springfield areas are seeing increases that are significant. The Dole plant in Clark County had 200 workers tested positive. On the other hand, the average, the death rate is lower than the average at 26. So is there any way to summarize how Ohio's managing at this point in the process? Laura?
Well, on Friday and on Thursday of last week, we had like 610 new cases on Friday, 700 on Thursday. That's a big jump over what had been the 21-day new case average of about 435 cases per day. The trick is, we're doing more testing, so we just may be capturing more cases overall. And the governor, he called the cases in Southwest Ohio worrisome. He identified Clark, Greene, Hamilton, Montgomery, and Warren counties. It's really kind of unclear if that's like a long-term worrisome problem or just a blip, because I think shortly thereafter he said that the R naught, the replication, how many people get infected from each case, when you want to have it below one. It was slightly above one in the Southwest Ohio area, and now it's settled back down again, I think. And also, the Dole plant in Springfield, last I checked, they had 270 cases.
270 now, wow. Adrian Robbins, Who's at the presser now with the governor? If Amy Acton's not there anymore, who are we seeing at those things? What's the plan?
Right. Well, recently it's just been Governor DeWine and then Lieutenant Governor John Husted. The governor has brought in kind of these special guest doctors, whether it be a pediatrician to maybe talk about the coronavirus in children, or we had the head of the Cleveland Clinic the one day. The governor has just been reading his own numbers, but it does make it difficult to ask health-related questions right. That previously would have headed towards Dr. Acton. And now we don't necessarily have that voice of a medical professional there at the press conferences.
You know, it seemed like on paper, at least, that the state health director, former one now, Amy Acton, and the lieutenant governor who was in charge of job development and how things were managed on that score were always kind of at odds. I mean, on paper, is there any sense that they were at odds behind the scenes, Joe Ingles?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, we don't know what went on behind the scenes, right? But we do know that the health director there, that she was in those conversations. We don't know how much of the frustration was there, you know? We do know that there were times when it appeared that there was some disagreement, but mm-hmm. we don't know for certain what was going on there.
Any sense about that, their conflicting roles, Adrian Robbins?
I mean, I think Dr. Acton, her job is obviously to focus on the health of Ohioans, specifically when it came to the coronavirus. So she's always going to be on that side. At the same time, the lieutenant governor, his main role was unemployment and businesses. He's hearing from these business owners. But I feel like it's best to have two people on those opposite sides so that everyone's voices are obviously being heard. And then it's obviously up to the governor. And as he said, all of the orders were his.
In the final analysis, though, the lieutenant governor is still with us. And Amy Acton is behind the scenes at best, Laura Bischoff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Adrian's right. You know, John Husted, he used to be the vice president of the Dayton Chamber of Commerce. He mm-hmm. comes from very much a business background or, you know, business advocacy background. And then, you know, Amy Acton is an expert in public health. And so they have very different views. And I think that the governor probably values both of their counsel. And that's why, you know, you still see Amy Acton moving into a more internal role. John Husted is the elected lieutenant governor.
If there's another surge, if there's a surge like they've predicted there will be in the fall, who is going to make those orders? Is there a sense that there's a vacuum now there, Laura?
Well, at this point, I would presume that the governor will get somebody in that role by fall. Mm. Because, you know, we're still in the first wave.
Right.
Our first wave is a big, long plateau with, you know, undulations here and there. And, you know, the real concern is once students go back to school, to K-12 in the fall, and college students return to campuses, and people, again, let their guard down and they're out in public more, mm-hmm. then we may see that the true second wave.
As for how the state is managing the crisis financially, it's asking hundreds of state vendors, suppliers, and landlords this week to voluntarily cut what they're charging the state by 15%. What is the sense, Joe Ingles, that they're going to comply with this, that they can even afford to? The state's maybe the only thing keeping them afloat.
Right. And I mean, that's a big question mark, too, that we don't know that they can even comply with that. You know, a lot of this stuff. And if you look at it, I mean, there's so many moving pieces to it, so many different things that go into it that mm-hmm. it's hard to tell. I can't even answer that.
And this July 1, the kickoff of the next fiscal year is, you know, almost upon us. How are the state cuts and other cost-cutting measures going at this point, Laura Bischoff?
Well, the governor, you know, he announced, I think, toward the end of May that he was making $775 million in cuts to balance the current fiscal year, which ends June 30, mm-hmm. Which is only a week away. And I think you know, and he decided not to draw down anything out of the rainy day fund, which I think is at like $2.5 billion, maybe a little bit more than that, saying that they're going to need that for the upcoming fiscal year,
right,
which starts July 1st. And, you know, I think that they're already asking the employee unions that represent state workers to consider pay cuts or furloughs. The fall off in revenues is really going to be staggering.
Any sense, Joe Ingles, you had a story on voting reform group calling it quits. What's going on?
Well, they wanted to put something on the ballot in November that would make some voting reforms. And as you know, the legislature's made it harder in recent years to put things on the ballot. So they needed 440,000 ballot signatures, which means you need about twice that many signatures. Usually you get those at fairs and festivals. But this year with coronavirus, there aren't many fairs or festivals. There's not a lot of places to get those. So they had asked basically to be able to have online petitions, something that's never happened in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And they had asked for more time. A lower federal court said, yeah, you can have until the 31st and you can have those online petitions. But the state, they're not big on that, you know, either of those ideas. So they appealed that ruling. And a higher court came back and said, nope, you know, you still got to do it the way you were doing it. And it's due by July 1st. So,
yeah,
Tony Webb with the group, she said they had no choice but to say they can't do it right.
We lost you again, Joe. But I wonder, Adrian Robbins, when we ever go back to that signatures on a petition collection model.
I mean, I feel like it's hard to say when will the pandemic be over?
Right.
You know, we just don't know. And so it's hard to say when will we feel comfortable to be in big groups like that again, and actually have that ability to go in there and get signatures.
Right, right. A lot of unknown questions. So the legislature... How are they getting the budget put together if they're on vacation, Laura?
Well, like I said, the Senate does have some dates in July,
right,
and August, and has said that they, I think Larry Obhoff said, you know, given all the stuff that's going on with the budget and the protests and the pandemic, that they have an obligation to, you know, come back into session and deal with things. You know, staff is still working diligently. They're probably trying to figure out what changes they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, if it needed, you know, the governor can call the legislature back into session.
Okay. What are you guys going to be covering this week? Joe Ingles?
Well,
sorry,
one thing
laugh,
I want to add to that,
so
I don't know, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you real quick.
Okay. One thing I wanted to add to that is the state has now seen that this work from home model works in many places.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine all of those state office buildings, the leases that could be canceled if people were working from home and the money that could be saved there. So I think lawmakers will have to take a look at that issue. Mm. As far as this week, who knows what we're looking for? I think protests and coronavirus are the two big ones.
Can you sum it up likewise, Laura Bishop, that quickly?
Yeah, the same. And then I was going to add that one thing that's not also going to be moving this summer is gun bills. I did a story in Sunday's paper about how the one-year anniversary of the Dayton mass shooting is likely to pass without state lawmakers taking any action on the gun reforms that the governor has advocated.
How about you, Adrian Robbins?
I was going to say, I think protests and coronavirus are a very safe bet. They'll probably intersect at some point as well. But yeah, and it's always interesting even just hearing about gun bills. There are so many other things going on that have been kind of pushed into the corner.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be interesting to see what all kind of gets pulled out as the coronavirus and these protests slow down a little bit.
Well, Adrian Robbins, welcome aboard. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adrian Robbins, State House reporter for NBC4. Also, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Great to be here.
And Laura Bischoff, State Government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks as always, Laura.
Hey, it's always fun. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.